I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Katrin Flickshue, professor of political science at the London School of Economics. We're discussing her 2017 book, What is Orientation in Global Thinking? A Kantian Inquiry, from Cambridge University Press. Flickshue works on the political philosophy of Immanuel Kant, themes in global justice, and African philosophy. Her books include Kant and Modern Political Philosophy from Cambridge, and Freedom, Contemporary Liberal Perspectives from Polity. So first of all, let me say, Katrin Flickshue, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for asking me to talk to my book.
So I love this book. It's a really interesting nexus of three different ideas and approaches that one wouldn't expect together. The first one being a kind of sociology of philosophy that's inspired by Jonathan Lear's interesting book, Radical Hope. The second approach is an innovative reading of Kant, what you call in your preface a Kantian relativism, which is really, really interesting, which is really attentive to the openness and revisability of Kantian philosophy. And then third, an investigation of African philosophy on the self and the state. And so in the course of the conversation, I want to talk about each of these really interesting ideas. But first, let me just say, you know, this is a great contribution to the global justice literature. So thank you for writing the book.
Well, thank you for saying so. Let's see what other people think.
Yeah. So you talk in the preface about how these three different strands came together in the motivation for writing this book. Yeah. So could you say a little bit about how you were motivated to write the book?
Well, as I say in the preface, I was initially intending to write quite a different book, i.e. a book that dealt more directly with the reception of Kant in the recent global justice literature. And the idea for that book really had to do with my longer standing reservations about the tendency today in political theory and political philosophy to read Kant as more or less an early contemporary liberal, i.e. somebody who thinks very much like us. So it's always struck me that Kant thinks quite differently about a range of things, and in particular that his metaphysical commitments really don't give him the option to think much in the way in which we do, say, about freedom or about the state. So the idea had really been to say that Kant's cosmopolitanism is quite different, in many ways unsurprisingly so, of course, from contemporary global justice concerns. But I think that when I, the more I sort of began to think about what it is that disturbs me a bit about the global justice debate, the more I realize it wasn't really centrally its reception of Kant or its interpretation of Kant, but that it was really something else, and that is the parochialism of the debate, i.e. the philosophical parochialism, in the sense that much of the debate, if not most of it, is a kind of intra-liberal debate, i.e. Various liberal thinkers arguing the pros and cons of various substantive topics within a conception of global justice that is itself really inspired by Rawls's notion of distributive justice. So it seemed to me that if we're thinking about global justice, it's very odd to see that there's so little theoretical engagement with positions that lie outside what we know best, i.e. liberal theory, contemporary liberal theory. And so I began to realize that what really was really sort of eating me was the thought that what we call global justice is really just a globalized version of liberalism. And I think that one reason why I'm perhaps more struck by this than some of my colleagues is my exposure at various points in my career to the African continent, in particular West Africa, and Ghana and Burkina Faso, and to some extent Nigeria, and also seeing how people live differently there, how they have somewhat different concerns, how they think somewhat differently. So that bothered me more and more. And then it was through an African colleague of mine that that I began to read in African philosophy. It's not directly political philosophy. It's a much smaller field. So really, one should say African philosophy in general. And by this, I mean the post-independence emergence of a written academic philosophical discourse in Africa. So I started to engage with that, started to read that, and was in a way quite surprised to find that global justice didn't really figure very prominently in these debates. What figured in a way much more prominently was the very question of what is philosophy, or what could philosophy be in the African context. And I think that that question arises out of a critique of the Western tradition, and especially of the place that the Western tradition tends to assign Africa and Africans in its own thinking, i.e. subhumans, no culture, no civilization. So much of African philosophy is actually engaged in a critical analysis of the place of Africans in Western thinking, and an attempted response to that place, i.e. an attempt to affirm a distinctly African conception of human experience and human significance. And the more I read about that, the more I thought that, you know, it's really quite important for us, if we are doing global normative theorizing, it's quite important for us to try to engage with that, you know, that literature and that way of presenting Africa in our thinking. So that's really what led me to abandon the initial project of writing a book on Kant and contemporary global justice debates. But my real problem was, well, how do I go about bringing these things together? You know, bringing my reservations about the global justice debate, my interest in Kant, and my new interest in African thinking, which, to my surprise, but in retrospect, of course, not surprisingly, lacked this engagement with global justice that, in a sense, I had expected to find. And I think it was Jonathan Lear's book, Radical Hope, that was very important for me in terms of working out a kind of methodology in this book, i.e. a kind of way in which to try to bring these three strands in my thinking together. So it was Jonathan Lear's book on Radical Hope, this notion of conceptual loss in there, but also Thomas Nagel's PPA article, The Problem of Global Justice, which I'd read quite early on, and, you know, which had struck me as quite distinctive. And of course, the response to that article by global justice thinkers had been quite hostile, because in this article, Nagel suggests that, well, the way I read it, he suggests that it's not clear that on the conventional understanding of political liberalism, i.e. Rawls' inversion of liberalism, we can even really conceive of global justice obligations. And I found that very interesting. And combining that with Lear's analysis of conceptual loss then led me, in a certain sense, to turn the Lear-type problem around onto liberalism, because Lear, of course, argues that the Crow Indians face this problem of conceptual loss, i.e. they face the demise of their own culture, and with it, the demise of practices and concepts that had made sense to them. And now they were in this situation where they didn't know what to think anymore, and they didn't know what to do anymore. And I think it seemed to me that perhaps the global justice debate throws a similar challenge to us liberals, in the sense that it is a problem in relation to which it is not clear, to me at any rate, whether we have the concepts necessary adequately to theorize this problem. So I guess in Lear's work allowed me to take up Nagel's thought that perhaps we lack the theoretical resources, and to develop this perhaps more in more detail or more systematically into this claim that perhaps liberal theory as we know it is incapable of really grasping conceptually the problem of global justice. And that then leads to the further argument, well, if our tradition is incapable of grasping it, what do we do? Well, perhaps we should look at some other traditions of thought, just in order to begin to get some handle on what it might mean to think differently about, you know, us as human beings, and therefore what it might mean to think, to begin to think, perhaps not outside liberalism, but to begin to expand our sort of theoretical horizons in order to and enable ourselves to take on the views of others and the experiences of others more. So that's really sort of the background endeavor. And it seemed to me then also, finally, perhaps, that Kant, or studying Kant, you know, Kant is a historical thinker. And as I said to begin with, it had always struck me that Kant's thinking is quite different from contemporary liberalism. It doesn't mean that Kant is hostile or that he's not somebody who can contribute to contemporary liberalism, but his thinking is different. And I think that anyone who studies a historical thinker seriously will find this not surprising, that, you know, we can't easily translate Kant's thinking into our own without some sort of break. And so in some way, it seems to me that studying a historical thinker sort of prepares one a little bit for thinking differently from one's own contemporary mainstream. So in that sense, Kant as a historical thinker on the one hand and African contemporary philosophical debates on the other hand are both forms of thought that diverge in interesting respects from mainstream liberal thought, but not to such an extent that they are completely, that these three forms of thought are completely unintelligible to each other. So that's where I would resist the normal kind of relativist claim that, you know, if there are forms of thought that differ from each other, then therefore they can't be communicable to each other. But that's the basic background to the book.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I wanted to dig in a little bit more on the Jonathan Lear conceptual loss point, because this really, as you say, sort of frames the book in an important way, and is the way in, and your critique of the global justice literature. Yeah. In your view, the global justice literature really is undergoing a kind of conceptual loss. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that, the application of Lear's notion of conceptual loss to global justice literature, because in some ways there's a kind of asymmetry, and I mean, you note this in the book, you're aware of this, but there's an asymmetry between, on the one hand, the conceptual loss that's undergone by the Crow Indians in Lear's book, and then you know, kind of conceptual loss of an intellectual community. You know, on the one hand, you have a sort of a group of individuals who are undergo a kind of political persecution. On the other hand, you have very well off philosophers who occupy universities. I mean, there are a number of ways in which there are differences between the two groups. Maybe you could say a little bit about how it is that, you know, you can apply that concept outside of where Lear originated it.
Yeah. Well, of course, Lear himself, interestingly, and I think that's probably quite important. Lear himself, of course, interestingly says that although he's focusing on the Crow Indians, in a certain sense, they are, as it were, just a, you know, he doesn't put it like that, but they are, in a sense, a case study. He interestingly says that he thinks that conceptual loss is a permanent human possibility. So can, as it were, visit anyone, any cultural group, and any at any point in time. So at some point in the book, he in fact suggests that if we understand what happened to the Crow, according to him, we might ourselves better understand what he thinks of as our currently very anxious times. So it's quite interesting to note that Lear himself, I think, might have been motivated to examine the Crow Indians' experience of conceptual loss, in part because he perhaps sensed, or he perhaps believes, that we ourselves live in a time of what he calls heightened anxiety, and we can't quite understand what it is that we feel anxious about. But he suggests that there is a lot of anxiety about Western civilization, let's say, perhaps in the wake also of 9/11, and we can't quite name that anxiety. And so he himself suggests that conceptual loss is something, is a phenomenon that can befall any civilization at any point in time. So I think it's important for Lear that we don't read the book Radical Hope as an exercise in philosophical anthropology. Or if we do read it as an exercise in philosophical anthropology, then the emphasis should be on philosophical, i.e. the Crow experience is an experience that has general, is of general significance to the human condition. And so I think it's that claim on Lear's part, this idea that conceptual loss is a permanent possibility for any and all of us, that enabled me to then borrow that term and apply it to the global justice context. But of course, you're right to say that there's nonetheless this difference then between the Crow Indian as a culture and as a civilization and as a way of life, and on the other hand, the global justice debate as a highly theoretical, highly refined debate between quite a small group of academicians within the Western academic context. So obviously they're not communities of the same kind. I think what I thought nonetheless warranted making this kind of connection is in part the claim by this group of academicians to theorizing in a practically relevant way, i.e. global justice is not just an intellectual problem, but is primarily perceived and presented in the debate as a practical problem. And the global justice debate sets itself the task to, contribute to actually solving the practical problem. So there is a claim that what is being theorized is actually an imminent practical problem of global dimensions. So in that sense, of course, it is a way of life that is at stake. Yeah, if we take that claim seriously, that what we're really theorizing about is the current global condition, current global reality. So in that sense, I think there is a connection between a way of life, or rather our theorizing about a way of life and the Lear context. But what really sort of struck me now more in terms of the debate itself, I think that in the global justice debate, when one sort of sees how that debate has evolved over the last 20 or 30 years, my sense was that the place of the state is quite ambivalent in it. I remember that early debates were quite confident about the state withering away, as it were, the state being replaced by some sort of set of global institutions that would dispense justice, without state borders, as it were. And then as the debate continued, it became much more state centric again, and so there was this feeling that on the one hand early global justice theorists wanted to overcome the state, and on the other hand subsequent generations of global thinkers either didn't want to or didn't think it was overcomable. So in the end, it seemed to me that the state, the concept of the state, plays this function in the global justice debate that suggests that we actually find it very difficult to do political theory that is not in some sense, that does not in some sense depart from the state as a given. And yet the global justice debate puts that concept into question. So it was kind of thinking about the role of the state and the uncertain place that various global justice thinkers assign the place in that the state in that debate that led me to think that, well, perhaps within the global justice debate, what we are losing, or what we're not quite, what we don't quite know what to do with anymore, is the concept of the state. So the thought then was that perhaps just like the Crow Indians lost a central practice, the practice of coup counting when they moved onto the reservation, so perhaps the global justice debate puts into question a central political concept of ours, the concept of the state. And of course, if that happens, then all sorts of other concepts also become come to be at sea, i.e. the notion of political obligation, citizenship, indeed political institutions. So the thought was that perhaps the global justice debate is throwing us into a kind of conceptual disarray that we're not quite acknowledging, but that we sense through this ambivalence that we have with regard to the concept of the state in relation to the problem of global justice.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because the usual, I think, criticism of, say, liberalism on the in the cosmopolitan sphere comes from critical theory folks or post-colonialists,
yes,
who, you know, charge liberalism with, you know, there's a kind of Eurocentrism, yes, or Orientalism or some such thing, that, you know, so the charge is that liberalism is imperialist. What I find attractive about your view is that, you know, there's a kind of self-reflexive or self-recursive confusion or vertigo, conceptual vertigo, that goes on when the kind of extension of liberal ideas goes global. And that's something that's missing, I think, from the sort of critical theory people. I'm thinking of, you know, so like Amy Allen came to Rice a couple weeks right. ago, and I saw her talk, and she has this criticism of Habermas. It's called The End of Progress. It's some pokes up with some of the things that you're talking about and mm-hmm. challenging the idea of liberal progress on a global scale. Have you thought about how your view sort of agrees and disagrees with that sort of broad set of other thinkers who are, I think, trying to challenge liberalism from that side of things?
Yeah. It's very interesting what you say. I think it was actually very important to me and perhaps this is where the Kantian methodological element comes in. It was, I think, very, very important to me to try to think through this problem from within the liberal standpoint, i.e. not to take liberalism as a theory that's out there and that I have nothing to do with, or that I'm, you know, that I think is a wrong theory anyway, and to present an alternative superior theory, against it, as it were. It was very important to me to, in a way, think in terms of, you know, to ask whether it would be possible for us as liberals to acknowledge to ourselves that we might have a problem. Now, why was this important to me? I think that's broadly how Kant proceeds. You know, I think when he does philosophy, I think Kant takes, as is well known, the anthropocentric standpoint, but I think he also takes the first personal standpoint. He asks himself, what can I know, what ought I do, and what may I hope for? And I think that the first personal standpoint is very, very important to Kant's manner of philosophical thinking, because he is trying to work out a problem that he himself has. And so I wanted to be working out this problem, counting myself as a liberal who is confused about liberalism, i.e. who has been thrown into a state of confusion by the problem of global justice. So, and again, I think that also links up with Lear's approach, because I think that you can't really theorize conceptual loss in the way in which he does it from anywhere outside the first personal standpoint. And I think that with regard to, say, critical theory or post-colonial studies, one thing that does... I'm not a critical theorist, so I don't want to, you know, I don't want to kind of engage in cheap arguments against them. But one thing that I do sometimes that maybe post-colonial studies illustrates this better. This assumption that there is a right and wrong, and that we can diagnose what's wrong, say, about liberalism from the correct position, say, post-colonialism. And I'm just not sure that there is such a right or wrong that can be, as it were, objectively determined before one even gets into the examination of the problem. So I'm not sure. There's a very good book by Russell Berman with regard to the post-colonial discourse, and it's called Empire or Enlightenment, and it really looks at the incipient imperial thinking in the Enlightenment discourse, especially by examining certain travelogues, i.e. people who traveled to distant contexts and then wrote about them. And in the final chapter of this book, he criticizes post-colonial thinking, because post-colonial thinking has this tendency to see, as it were, the errors of everyone else, but not perhaps therefore to see its own errors. And so that's that I think is a weakness in post-colonial thinking, and perhaps in critical theory as well, this assumption that of having arrived at the correct position and then being able to judge other positions from that correct position. And I think that is something that I find unhelpful. I think that liberalism also does this, by the way. I think, you know, liberalism also tends to assume that, say, in the human rights debate, it knows what the correct answers to this and that are, and then it criticizes, say African communal thinkers for failing to see what's correct about human rights. So I'm not saying that critical theory or post-colonial studies are unique in this. In fact, I think much liberal thinking also takes this position that it alone is correct. But I don't find that very helpful, I guess, to you know, have this sort of standpoint and then look for people who disagree with one and, in a sense, simply affirm one's own standpoint. I'm not being very clear at the moment, but it was very important to me to try to do the thinking from inside liberalism.
No, that's helpful. I'm wondering in general about where this conceptual loss came from. If you have a general view about that, I mean, is there something implicit you think in liberalism or liberal principles itself, or was this more of a sort of accidental contingent feature of the development of scholarship in 20th and 21st century philosophy? I'm wondering that in part because I'm wondering, you know, what are the ways to overcome this conceptual loss, either in training or institutionally?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, the conceptual loss is as it were a thesis. You know, it's not. I'm not sure that, as it were, it's real. It's an attempt to diagnose a problem. But I do think that. So to go back to this point that I made about the centrality of the state, I mean, it's something that Rawls clearly sees, that, you know, we have been thinking about the state ever since Hobbes, and we have refined our thinking about the state and our political thinking generally, always with reference to the state. So we have taken the state pretty much for granted. And I think the global justice debate puts that into question. And of course, what perhaps puts it into even sharper question is the experience of post-colonial societies, such as African societies, where the state can precisely not be taken for granted. And so when liberal thinkers think politically, I think that they tend to think about political practices and political concepts with implicit background reference to the institutional context and the conceptual context that the idea of the state provides. And so even when they think then about the international context or the global context, many of their concepts are in fact informed by the history of political theory as we have known it, at least since Hobbes. And that, to me, is interesting, because if you then look at an African, at the post-independent African context, where the state is in question, to put it mildly, then it's not clear to me that liberal theory is able to grasp that kind of political context. Yet that political context forms part of the global context, the global political context. And I think the way in which liberal theories might respond to this is by saying, well, these are failed states. But in a certain sense, that is really just to, as it were, put a bucket over the problem and to refuse to go and look and see what actually goes on in these contexts, and perhaps entertain the thought, no, they're not failed states. It just may be that the concept of the state doesn't really grasp that political reality. So I do think that conceptual loss in liberal theory, in the sense that it challenges what we have always taken for granted, what we have, quite understandably, taken ourselves for granted, i.e. the whole context of the state, I do think that is a possible reality for us, that we do not understand many of the political contexts that are realities today and that we engage with practically and theoretically, but we don't actually understand what it is that we're engaging with.
That is very relevant, I think, for my next question, which has to do with the audience of the book, which is, primarily, of course, I mean, we write for other scholars, so we're writing for other professors. But I'm wondering if your view about conceptual loss in general has anything to speak to say, actors within the state or non-governing institutions or so forth and so on. What strikes me when I think about sort of international relations and foreign policy is, I mean, at least the United States has been oscillating between a general view about a kind of liberal universalism since Woodrow Wilson, at least, and a kind of live and let live, yeah, quasi-relativism. Do you have any thoughts on that, about how if you were to speak to, a State Department official calls up and say, mm-hmm, what can we learn from the book? Is there anything that your view can, speak to political actors?
To be quite honest, I haven't thought about that at all, really. I don't think I had that audience in mind while writing the book. So it's a very interesting question. What the audience I primarily had in mind probably are, I'll say, fellow liberal thinkers. So, of course, I mean, I think that I'm known, to the extent that I'm known, I am known as somewhat of a disgruntled Kantian within the liberal within the liberal tradition. So in a way, I think in this book, it was quite important to me not to come across as hostile, like I said to you before, but to take the first personal, as it were, I'm also a liberal struggling with this. So I think my primary audience would be fellow liberal theorists who are in some way engaged with the problem of global justice. And my hope would have been that in casting myself as, lumbered with the same problem, that I would come across not as preaching to them, but in a way saying, well, look, I think we might have a problem here. Now, does this book have practical, would it have, could it interest someone who's more in the practical side of politics? I don't know. Because of course it's in some way quite a demanding book because of the Kant element and the African philosophy element. At the same time, I would hope that it's written in a style that is in principle accessible to others. I do also think that sometimes we underestimate political practitioners, because I think that they might have, in fact, often a better grasp of the gap between theory and practice. Yeah, that they might often understand better that Well, there's liberal theory, and then there's political practice, and then there's all these different international contexts, and we have to negotiate with people who think very differently about us. So I'm not sure how much I could hope that they would have the patience to read it.
Right. Yeah, maybe another book. What is Orientation in Action, or rather than thinking, like I'm not that. Sure. But you know, I mean, you're right. I mean, in reading the book, it's certainly, I mean, even with the Kantian section, which we'll get to right now, is there's a really helpful way in which you're placing an emphasis on self knowledge, on investigating the self, which strikes me as a very helpful lesson for political actors, quite frequently.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
So let's talk about Kant. I love Kant. You've done a lot of work on Kant. I was really struck by this formulation, although you use it in quotation marks, called Kantian relativism, which I find interesting. But
yes.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about your view of a kind of dynamic, open-ended Kant. In part, you're influenced by Karl Americh and thinking about Kant. The title of your book refers to Kant's essay, What is Orientation in Thinking? And I was wondering if you wanted to say a little bit about that essay as maybe a springboard into thinking about, you know, Kant's method as you understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, of course, I mean, as I say in the book itself, What is Orientation in Thinking, Kant's essay, probably... The thing I like best about it is the title, and I struggled for quite a lot in writing of this book. On the one hand, the title question really, really struck me, and on the other hand, I thought, well, but Kant's own essay is really about something quite different. I.e., it arises in the context of the pantheism debate, and it's ostensibly, at least in part, to do with the question of what sort of claims is it defensible to make about, say, the existence of God or the existence of a perfectly rational being. So in a certain sense, the content of the orientation essay, the immediate content of it, is far removed from the question that I have, which is more to do with global justice. But it's more when Kant then speaks in more general terms in this essay about how it is that we orient our thinking, that I then saw the relevance of, you know, not just the title question, but also of his general philosophical thinking. And what really struck me in the essay is how he ends up saying that we orient ourselves primarily with reference to ourselves. So he has this example of being led into a darkened room, and you know all the you know from experience all the position of the furniture in this room, but now the room is completely dark and you're in the middle of it. And he claims that if you can find one piece of furniture, let's say, to your left, then you can mentally place all the other pieces in the room relative to that piece. And so you can orient yourself by, as it were, reconstructing the furniture in the room mentally, using your sense of left and right. So that's a subjective point of orientation. And then later on, he goes on and suggests that in our thinking too, we orient ourselves in a certain sense subjectively. And by that, I take him to mean that we can really only, and this of course feeds into the first critique, we can really only know what we know through relying on our subjective capacities for knowledge. So obviously for Kant, our cognitive capacities interact with what the world feeds to them, so to speak. And similarly in the orientation essay, he I think goes on to suggest that when it comes to these big questions about the existence of God, these lie for Kant beyond all possible knowledge for us, but we can nonetheless listen in a certain sense to our subjective need for belief in God. So what was interesting to me was this thought that it is our subjective feeling of left and right on the one hand, and then our subjective needs of reason that orient our thinking. And I think that goes, of course, together with Kant's general anthropocentrism, i.e. We can know what we can know only from the human standpoint. So we have to orient ourselves using, as it were, ourselves as our point of orientation. So how does that feed into the book? Well, I think one of the things you said, you know, in terms of how does this perhaps feed into the book, in terms of my reading of Kant in that book, I think one of the things that's very important to my understanding of Kant is precisely Kant's emphasis on the limits of knowledge in order to make room for faith. And of course, that figures not just in Kant's religion, but also in Kant's practical philosophy, i.e. his claim, on my understanding, that the idea of freedom is central to us, but it is an idea. It is an idea of reason, and it is not something that we can have any knowledge of, the reality of which we can have any knowledge of. So this idea of our insight into our own limitations, I think, is very crucial to my understanding of Kant. And I think it is precisely that which enables Kant also to revise his position and to change his mind. So here I think Amorex's reading of Kant as somebody who has an open system, the system is not complete, the Kantian architectonic is not sort of written in stone, but that Kant is always led to ask further questions, and in the asking of the further question is always ready to revise his initial answers. And quite often, of course, frustratingly, he doesn't tell us, well, I used to think X, but now I think Y in the light of, you know, further reflection. But Kant is known to revise his thinking all the time in the light of sort of further additions to his sort of systematic inquiry. A very good example of this, I think, is precisely the practical philosophy, i.e. Groundwork, which is often read as sort of definitive of Kant's practical philosophy. But once the Doctrine of Right was written, and then once the Metaphysics of Morals was written, many of the things that are being, as it were, said in Groundwork don't really make sense anymore unless one is prepared to revise Groundwork in the light of the Doctrine of Right. But Kant doesn't, of course, say, and now we have to think about Groundwork differently. So he fails to really tell his readers very often that, well, I've changed my mind. But I think, again, that often, to my mind, that suggests that he is primarily constantly reworking out in his own mind what he thinks about X, Y, and Z. So it's the openness of Kant's thinking that I think lends itself to this problem that I'm looking at in this book, i.e. how are we going to rethink liberalism in the light of the global challenges? Can we rethink liberalism in the light of the global challenges? And I think it's a question we shouldn't be afraid to ask. You know, we should not be worried about, well, if we admit that liberalism is perhaps in some sort of crisis, are we going to show our weak side? No, I don't think so. I think we're going to show our reflective side and our potential for sort of self-inquiry. So I think Kant's method to me is open precisely because of this acknowledgement that we cannot know with finality. We must, of course, judge, and we must always reach certain judgments. But these judgments must be permanently revisable, precisely because all we have is a subjective point of orientation that must remain open to new experiences, and that then must allow for revision of initial judgments.
Yeah, that, really interesting part of that, I think, what were at least what I found to be really illuminating is your discussion of the first person character of Kant's analysis and the regressive sort of argument that follows from that, that in the practical philosophy, how you point out the how one starts with first person experience and then works back to the conditions for the possibility of that experience. And that, on your view, can open up all sorts of different kinds of conditions for diversity of various kinds of experiences. So I was wondering if we could talk about one of the great examples you use, which is about Kant's argument in the Metaphysics, Morals, and the Doctrine of Right about the duty to join a state, which Kant says is an enforceable duty. You also point out a little bit later in the Metaphysics of Morals when Kant is talking about how European peoples should relate to nomadic peoples, and you find that the argument to the duty to join a state doesn't hold, at least for those nomadic peoples. So you could talk a little bit more about that and how that illustrates this sort of openness.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, what Kant says about the nomads or nomadic peoples in the Doctrine of Right is very, very short, very brief, and clearly, what I'm offering in the book is an interpretation. I'm not necessarily wanting to say that this is exactly what Kant thought. I would want to say more that this is here's a possible way of reading Kant's in many ways quite cryptic remarks. But I started my my work on the Doctrine of Right by initially I thought I was going to write on Kant's cosmopolitanism, and then I really, when I was doing my PhD, I got stuck on the property argument, which is a fascinating, very obscure, very difficult argument. But so in the beginning of the Doctrine of Right, you get this very powerful, if obscure, argument in behalf of the a priori necessity of state entrance. So the claim is something like, if you lay claim to external objects of your choice, you can permissibly do so only through entrance into the state, and this is because your claim to a given object of your choice is a unilateral claim that cannot be defended against others who might equally claim objects of their choice as theirs, unless there is a public authority that can adjudicate impartially, if you like, between these claims. So you get this non-contractualist obligation of state entrance, which Kant, at the beginning of Doctrine of Right, asserts as an a priori obligation, so an unconditionally valid obligation, in which he seems to derive from some argument about the acquisition of objects, which is itself tied to a conception of external freedom. So the suggestion there is, you as an agent, you cannot but act, and as an agent, you cannot but take into your possession certain objects of your choice. So there the claim seems to be very much that some form of property acquisition is unavoidable if you are an agent who acts under the idea of his own practical freedom. And yet in the final pages of the Doctrine of Right, when he talks about settlers coming to, and I'm sure he has them in mind primarily the Americas, there he seems to then... There he then basically says that these settlers cannot claim as theirs the lands over which nomadic peoples roam, even though the lands over which nomadic people roam are not lands which the nomadic people seem themselves to claim as theirs. So while Kant, of course, would say, if those peoples say that these are their lands in the sort of property sense of their lands, then these would be their lands, and the settlers would not be entitled simply to deprive the nomads of these lands. But what Kant interestingly says is that, or he intimates that, even if the nomads have no conception of these lands as theirs in the property sense, then the settlers cannot treat these lands as res nullius, i.e. as belonging to no one. So they cannot simply take these lands from nomadic peoples. But he goes further and suggests that even though you might say that when the settlers come, say, to the Americas and they encounter, say, the American Indians, then what you have is a typical case of property disputes, which can only be resolved, according to Kant's earlier argument, through common entrance into a state. So one might say that the settlers and the American Indians are now involved in some dispute over who owns the lands. And then for Kant, this would ordinarily only be resolvable through common entrance into the state. But he rejects that. He says that, well, the settlers cannot compel the nomadic peoples into a state, either with each other or with the settlers. They can only deal with the nomadic peoples on the basis of a sort of contractual arrangement, i.e. if the nomadic peoples are willing to cede some lands to the settlers, then there needs to be some sort of contractual arrangement. And all of this is very, very peculiar, because for Kant, a contractual arrangement is only possible in the state. So he refers to all sorts of arrangements that are only possible in the state, and yet he denies that the nomadic peoples either are in a state or are under duty of state entrance. And so what I found really interesting was the affirmation of a priori duty of state entrance at the beginning of the text, and the apparent denial of nomadic peoples as being under a duty of state entrance at the very end of the text. And there wasn't really a sense on Kant's part, or there didn't really seem to be a sense on Kant's part that there's a tension here, or that there's an outright contradiction here. So in a way, I was trying to work out, well, how can you square these two things? How can both of these be consistent? And I suppose what I then began to think is, well, if Kant says that the duty of state entrance is, as it were, a corollary of your claim to a given object of your choice as yours, and if we suppose that nomadic peoples do not regard the land over which they roam as an object which they can possess, then one might say that the duty of state entrance is relative to whether or not you commit the act that generates the relevant duty, i.e., there is an unconditional duty to enter into the state if you acquire property, but there is no such duty if you don't commit the relevant act of acquisition. That was my thinking that, and of course that then relativizes this a priori duty of state entrance to those who do in fact commit the relevant act.
Yeah, it's a strange passage in many ways in the Metaphysics of Morals. I'm just staring at it right now. I mean, Kant says I won't read a long passage to put people to sleep. But he says, but if these peoples are shepherds or hunters, like the Hottentots, Tungsi, and many American Indian nations, then he says, who depend for their sustenance on great open regions?
Yes.
The settlement may not take place by force. So it is, so you're right. He doesn't say, that it's these nomadic peoples have claimed these as property, but he does say that they depend on those open regions for their sustenance, yeah. Right? So, the argument seems to be that, well, you can't take away their lands because then they would sort of lose a right to life or something like that, which doesn't seem to be consistent with the way that Kant argues earlier. So it is a kind of puzzle. I mean, that your reading certainly is more plausible than some of the others you canvassed there. It still is rather a strange passage.
I think it's a very strange passage. It's precisely his emphasis on the nomadic peoples depending for their sustenance on these lands that led me to the thought, well, if that's what he's saying, this suggests that he does not think that they claim this as a property. Because in the earlier property argument, of course, he's very emphatic in saying that use is not a criterion for property ownership. Mm-hmm. What is a criterion for the claim to an object is choice of it as yours, whether you need it or whether you want it or whether you know you can have it is neither here nor there. It's simply the fact that you claim it as yours. Whereas the nomads use the lands, but do not seem thereby to claim it. And even if they were to claim it on the basis of using it, this would not qualify as a property argument for Kant. So I was very struck by the fact that he emphasizes their use of it, and precisely for that reason seems to assume that they don't claim it they don't claim property rights over it. And I think, I mean, not that this is especially relevant, but I think that when one reads accounts of how many indigenous peoples think of their relationship to their land, they often seem to want to avoid invoking property ownership. Yeah, they want to have a different kind of relationship to the land. So I think I don't think that Kant understood that, but what I was struck by is the fact that here we have a way of life that the settlers encounter, and Kant seems to somehow understand that this is a way of life that is different from the European way of life, and he seems to somehow understand that we cannot necessarily judge it by the criteria that are valid for the European way of life. And I was very struck by that. Because, of course, right, means that he potentially has to revise his judgment.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so presumably the idea is something like this, that the property argument and the doctrine of right starts from the perspective of, say, European private property rights, yeah, and regresses upon those conditions. And so, you know, if Kant were to have expanded his, you know, if he had gone to speak to the Hottentots or something like, yeah, that, he, you know, he could have developed another chapter in the doctrine of right, which would regress upon the conditions of their experience. Yes. Is that something like that? I mean,
something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Katrine.
No, sorry. So if I understood you correctly, he starts from a European set of assumptions at the beginning of the text, and in a certain sense, one might read them as finding at the end of the text that those set of assumptions don't apply to the nomadic context. So if he were to develop a theory that applies both to the Europeans and to the nomadic peoples, he would have to now start from a rather different set of assumptions, ones that are not indexed, yeah, to the European experience in particular. So that was my thought. But of course, then the other thought is also that if it's a practical philosophy, it will always have to start from a certain set of assumptions that are valid in the context to which the philosophy addresses itself. So I'm not sure, I'm not sure anymore whether there is a global context, i.e. whether there is a context in which, whether there's a context of agency that whether we can have an account of morality or an account of political morality that is valid for all contexts. I mean, the set of assumptions that you can make about that would seem to be so minimal that I'm not quite sure how much you can derive of that. Maybe that's what I think somebody like Honora O'Neill tries to do. Yeah, she tries, mm-hmm, I think, to work with a set of assumptions that are potentially valid for all contexts of agency globally. And she herself, I think, acknowledges that she can derive principles that are of such high generality that it's not entirely clear how much, how directly action guiding they can be. And I suppose I have probably moved more in the direction where I think, and perhaps Rawls has been an influence here for me, where I think that principles of action are contextual if they're going to be practical. So they have to, for them to be adequate to their context of application, they have in some sense to draw on background assumptions that are themselves taken from those contexts. And that's, of course, quite Rawlsian, actually, I now realize.
Mm-hmm. And this is all quite a radical interpretation of Kant.
Yes.
Because we're used to thinking of Kant as a, you know, here I'm laying down these universal rules. And it, in some ways, my initial thought was to think, you know, this holds, I think, more strongly for his political thought than his moral thought, where he seems to really sort of insist on a kind of universality and necessity. Yeah. But then when I thought more about the moral theory, it strikes me there's a lot of room for, in Kant's view, varying empirical conditions, which really shape the application of the moral law. The moral law is itself universal and necessary. But as you say, there's a kind of indeterminacy to it. This is where, you know, scholars of Kant's moral philosophy have published reams and reams of analysis about, you know, how to apply the moral law. And, you know, in part, maybe the answer is, well, it just sort of depends on the, you know, social and cultural conditions in which one finds oneself. I mean, do you have the same thought that, you know, I mean, because you talk in large part about the political theory here, but that the same would hold for the moral theory?
Yes, I do. And I think I do realize that that's quite contentious. And I think this is maybe one of the instances where what I said earlier applies, i.e. that once you familiarize yourself with the doctrine of right, that has implications for how you read the groundwork. Because I think that it is easier to read the groundwork as, you know, as it is traditionally read, in the sense that you just outlined, i.e. here you have the categorical imperative, and the categorical imperative, you know, is valid for all. The expectation is then that you can derive from it principles of action that are valid for all. And I think that one of the things that happens when you read the doctrine of right is that the distinction there is introduced between internal freedom and external freedom. And then there's much, Kant makes very much of the difference between maxims and action, i.e. having good maxims is one thing, but doing the right action is, as it were, another thing. And then, of course, the doctrine of right is all about external morality, so the rightness of actions. And it says, it is not interested in maxims. It's not interested in your maxim of action. So the reasons for why you act rightly don't really matter. Whereas in groundwork, of course, the focus is on goodness of maxim or goodness of will. And so I certainly began to think, well, if what's important for groundwork is that your maxim be, as it were, morally good, and if it's also important for groundwork that you legislate the moral law to yourself, then it seems that what you're really required to do for the purposes of the groundwork is to ask yourself whether you think that the maxim of action that you propose to act on is such that anyone in your situation could act on it, i.e. you're asking yourself whether it is universalizable in your judgment. And if so, then it is permissible for you to act on it, and if not, not. But I think the groundwork is often read as suggesting that if you judge that your maxim is universalizable, then you are in some sense warranted on legislating it to others as well. But that makes no sense to me anymore, because if we're each asked to test our own maxims, then of course we must each test our own maxim. We can't legislate to others. In the doctrine of right, others are legislated to by the public authority. But I think in groundwork, you can really only legislate to yourself, and you can really only judge for yourself whether you think your maxim is universalizable. And that then leads me to the thought that different people could well, in groundwork, judge differently about a proposed maxim. So you could judge that your proposed maxim is not universalizable, and I might judge that a maxim of a very similar kind is in fact universalizable. So my thought was that ethical judgments can diverge, and quite legitimately so, if we each, to the best of our abilities, reach this conclusion with regard to our maxim that yes, it is universalizable, or no, it isn't universalizable. So I think that there is a kind of context sensitivity in groundwork that allows each individual to reach his or her own judgment with regard to the maxim that they propose to act on. And I think the idea that through the categorical imperative we also legislate for others becomes quite problematic as a reading of groundwork in light of the doctrine of right, where you do in fact have somebody who legislates for others, but it's a public authority. So I would say that in the realm of virtue, which the groundwork is about, we must each judge for ourselves. And in the realm of right, which the doctrine of right is all about, public judgments are made, but by a publicly designated authority.
Mm. That's great. We could talk for hours, I'm sure, about Kant. I want to finish though by talking about African philosophy, mm-hmm. which is the third part of the book. So you turn to sort of enact what it is that you were advocating for, which is to expand the reach of global justice theory.
Yeah.
And so you look at some African philosophical literature on the self and the state. Well, I thought we had to talk a little bit about the idea of the self as you develop it, with the idea of the person, which, according to some theories, extends to ancestors, mm-hmm. which I found to be a really interesting idea. I wanted you to maybe first say a little bit about, you know, what that means to extend personhood to ancestors, and then we can talk a little bit about the implications of it. But so first, what does it mean to extend personhood to ancestors?
Well, that's a line of argument offered by Ifeanyi Minkiti in his article on the normative conception of the person. But I think it is quite a prevalent, thought in much traditional African thinking. And Minkiti there outlines it in terms of what he calls a maximal conception of the person. And that conception, I think, actually shares certain elements with virtue ethical conceptions of personhood, in the sense that Minkiti argues that on many African traditional conceptions of personhood is an achievement it is achieved through communal living. So personhood is a moral achievement that is practiced through community living. So he gives you the account of a person he gives you the account of a human being. He distinguishes between human beings and persons. So a human being as on a journey to personhood throughout his or her communal living. So he suggests that personhood as a maximal concept means that when you start your life as an infant, at that point you're not yet a person, because you're not yet capable of taking on any communal obligations, and therefore you also concomitantly lack any communally conferred entitlements. But as you progress through your life as a child, and then as an adolescent, as a young adult, and so on, you take on more and more obligations and fulfill different tasks of being a communal member, and so you grow into being a person. And I think his thought is that each stage in your life is folded into each subsequent state. So you mature morally by taking on these roles and you know, living through these different stages of being human. But he then interestingly also says that ancestorship is that state where a person is biologically dead but morally alive. So an ancestor is somebody who has died but whose moral authority is still with the community. So this being is still a person in the sense that he or she is still recognized as somebody who has moral authority within the community. In fact, probably as somebody who is at the height of their moral community, their moral authority vis-a-vis the community. What's ambiguous in Menkiti is not clear to what extent he commits himself to these ancestors actually still being there in some sense. So they're biologically dead, but the idea is that they're not just alive in people's memory of them, but that they exist in some sense in a non-bodily state. So they are in this world, they are disembodied, but they're not just figments of the imagination. They are kind of, it's a state of being human that persists in a non-physical sense, but in this world. And then the final stage is what Menkiti calls nameless death. And when nameless death happens is when basically ancestorship descends into nothingness again. So it's a kind of arc where you start from infancy and a non-person status, and you grow into a person, and your highest point of personhood is at ancestorship, and then you descend into, as it were, nothingness again. But that's the basic account of ancestorship that I was working with in that chapter that you're referring to.
Yeah, I found this really intriguing. I mean, in part because it strikes me that it isn't a view that's explored in liberal thinking. I mean, liberal. I mean, even thinking about, you know, Thomas Jefferson has this line about you know, the dead are dead. We shouldn't be ruled by the dead hand of the past. Right. I mean, so it's a kind of, I mean, liberals, of course, have a view about the sort of rights of our descendants or the rights of future peoples and their struggle about that. But the idea of rights of the people of the past is certainly somewhat foreign. I mean, it strikes me that it shares a fair bit in common with conservatism.
Yes, I'm sure that's right.
Yeah. I mean, I kept on thinking about, say, the example of the burning of the American flag and why conservatives hate that. You know, you might think it's in part because there's a sort of thought that the past people who have fought for the country, our ancestors, are sort of implicit in that symbol. Yeah. It confers on them a right and a duty to repay. You read it as sort of conservative in orientation there, similar to that, or is there some distinction there?
Well, I think to some degree there probably is a kind of conservatism that forms, I think, part of it, in the sense that clearly on Menkiti's view, if personhood is something that you become more and more of, i.e., if you become more and more of a person as a result of you know, having acquired, if you like, more and more moral wisdom, then of course the elderly would be seen as repositories of what's morally right to do. And so that itself, I think, would have the quite conservative implication that the younger you are, the less morally competent you are, and the older you are, the more morally competent you are. And of course, the older you are, the more conservative, in a sense, that sort of is a tendency. So I do think that there is that element to it. But I'm not sure that, that's not the one that centrally interests me. I think what interests me is more this idea of the fluidity of personhood. And perhaps it's not necessarily the ancestorship that communicates that, though it forms part of it. But this idea much more that on African conceptions, and my limited exposure to African communities does tend to confirm this. Being a person really, I think, is much more being part of a community than it is in our sense. And I don't think that contemporary liberal communitarian thought gets to that. The sense of you as a person is quite intimately tied in with you as being a community member. So what does that mean? I think it means, for one thing, that your essential relationship to your community is not antagonistic, and of course it needn't be in the liberal relationship between individual and society. It needn't be antagonistic either, but the tendency, I think, is to think that the society is always a potential threat to individual will and to individual innovation. And in the on the African understanding of the relationship between individual person and community is much more that the community helps you to become a person, and that therefore you also, in a certain sense, owe something back to the community, i.e. you owe the community engagement with the community. So I do think that there is quite a different conception of personhood at stake here. And in the book, I suggest that where you have a conception of the person that is much more tied into fulfilling community functions, but not in a way that is perceived in terms of the community oppressing you. But if you have such a conception, it may be much harder for you to think that that moral relations are best expressed in rights language, including human rights language. Because I think human rights language, or rights language, certainly does have the tendency to pitch the claims of one against the claims of the other. And here in the African conception, there is more of a, there is not a, it's, it, it is less antagonistic. It's much more communal.
Yeah, I had the thought of comparing it to communitarians, so that's helpful to get that distinction. My other thought was a kind of parallel with Hegel. I mean, Hegel's a kind of figure. I mean, in part, I was wondering in general about Hegel and your view about Hegel, because there are many ways in which you your reading of Kant sort of lends itself to a kind of Hegelian approach. But setting that aside, this view about personhood and its, you know, the coming to be of personhood via a kind of membership in an ethical community, sort of very much reminds me of Hegel's view about the transition from morality to ethical life, and how there's a kind of Bildung process that occurs when people become inducted into moral community, ethical communities rather, and gain their kind of personhood through that. I don't know if you thought in general about the presence of Hegel in your book, or in its connection with African philosophy.
It's very interesting that you pick that up. I haven't thought about Hegel at all, because I don't like Hegel.
Fair enough. Yeah,
he's my bête noire. He's the anti-Christ.
I see. Yeah. I talked to Terry Pinkard a couple.
Did you?
Sessions ago. So uh-huh. I won't tell him. Yeah.
No, but it's quite interesting, because I can see this. So let me just say a couple of things about why, you know, quite unfairly, I don't like Hegel, without really being able to claim much by way of having read Hegel. I've tried to read him a couple of times, and probably one of the reasons why I don't like Hegel is because I can't read him. I just find it very, very difficult to persevere with him. But the thought that immediately strikes me, I always suspect that with Hegel there is there is a kind of metaphysics in the background, some kind of absolute spirit, or some sort of end of history thing that I shy away from. And so then I wonder whether for Hegel the state, yeah, and communal living, or living in the state, is in some sense in the service of this metaphysical idea, this metaphysical idea of absoluteness, so that we have to go through these historical stages in order to overcome each preceding stage and reach a more perfect state of sorts. And so I would have thought that if that's the story, if there's some metaphysical story of perfectionism and some telos that gets us to some absolute spirit, I think that's lacking. That background story is lacking in African communalism. It's, I think, oddly much, much more imminent. Communal living is not really in the service of anything other than communal living. And I don't think that there is a kind of metaphysics of perfecting yourself through communal living. It is actually, there is no human life outside communal living. And in that sense, my own thought is that it's perhaps closer to virtue ethics than to Hegel. It's perhaps closer to a certain kind of Aristotelianism. But I wouldn't want to, you know, venture too much on that. But that's what struck me, that, you know, we couldn't be without community. It's not as though by turning to community living, we are somehow at a higher level of being. It's rather that that's the only way of human being there actually is. But I obviously have to think more about this and about Hegel. At some point, I have to make my peace with the man.
I see. Yeah, well, of course, Hegel is, as you say, as a very famous defense of the modern state, in which I mean, marks a very big difference with these African philosophers that you're discussing, who really have, for quite understandable reasons, due to the colonialist heritage, have a real problem with the state and are looking for sort of alternative forms of social and political organization to conceptualize community. I don't know if you want to say a little bit in conclusion about any of the kind of alternatives that are theorized in African philosophy, alternatives to the state.
Well, I mean, I think that's I think in this regard, African thinkers probably find themselves between a rock and a hard place, because I think that, and this is what I say in the concluding chapter, when I look at the, when I look at the African state, the modern African state, and how, in my view, liberal political theory has really failed to engage with that. As I said, I think a while ago, I think liberal theory tends to think of the African modern state as a failed state. And of course, behind that is the thought that ideally the African state would have evolved much like the European state, or should have evolved much like the European state. So the idea of a failed state suggests that the state doesn't meet certain criteria of success. And what would these criteria of success be? Well, they would be basically those criteria that we're going to associate with the European state formation, and perhaps the North American state formation. So I actually have begun to think that European states and the US are very different kinds of animals again. I think my impression from having read a number of African thinkers on this, my impression is that on the one hand, there is it is clear that the post-colonial state, i.e. the independent state, is an inheritance of the colonial state. So, and that the colonial state is in turn a very different kind of construct from the European state. The colonial state is institutionally very different and is is in terms of the notions of citizen right and citizen obligations is a very different thing. So what we have is in modern post-independence African states are their history is a colonial state, and it is not the kind of state formation that we saw in Europe and not the state formation that we saw in North America. So what you have there is a set of institutions that are quite different in their historical formation from the European example, and that nonetheless are sort of expected to perform more or less in accordance with the criteria of European state formation. And of course they're going to fail. They're going to fail if they're expected to perform on the basis of criteria that are not adequate to the type of institution that they are. So then there is, of course, discussion about what are the alternatives to the state in Africa. And the reality, I think, is that it's not clear that there is an alternative. And this is, of course, partly because we do live in a world of states internationally. That is the system that we're in, and it's not at all clear that the African continent could exempt itself from that system by deciding to go in some sense stateless. And that's what I mean by saying that African thinkers find themselves between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, it's fairly clear that the model of statehood has not is that the model of statehood, certainly that they have inherited from the colonial experience, is not adequate to their social situation. But on the other hand, it's not at all clear that there is an alternative, because the international system is such that political formations other than states are not going to really survive in it. So I'm not very optimistic in the medium term or in the short term, but I do think that one can learn from the African experience. I think in terms of, again, I think one comes back to thinking, well, we need to rethink the state in some way. We need to certainly move away from the European prototype and entertain the possibility of there being very, very different types of states. I imagine that were we to look at the Asian states, they too would actually look quite different from what we tend to assume when we talk about states. So even though I don't think that, you know, it's clear that there is an alternative, I would have thought that it's incumbent upon political theorists of the 21st century to learn to rethink the state, i.e. to move away from the European context and from the European model, and to be prepared to think, well, different types of this particular political formation do in fact exist. And so then we must adjust our normative conceptions of what a state is and of what a state can do accordingly.
Well, thank you so much, Katrine, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thanks for all your probing questions. And I hope I made some sense of the book, but
I'll leave absolutely. That. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.